welcome to Can I Butt In, the Bowel Research UK podcast, where we welcome bowel cancer and bowel disease patients, researchers, healthcare professionals and carers to butt in and share their experiences. We're picking a topic every episode and getting to the bottom of it. I'm your host, Sam Alexandra Rose. I'm the Patient and Public Involvement Manager at Bowel Research UK. And as a patient myself, I'm excited to bring more patient and researcher voices into the spotlight. Hello, hello. We're here for another episode of Can I Butt In? And it might sound like a small problem, but microscopic colitis is a big issue that we're drawing attention to today. I'm joined by Diane Kelsey, who was diagnosed with microscopic colitis in February 2021, shortly after retiring from teaching. Hi, Diane. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi. Hi, Sam. Thank you.
Lovely to have you. Do you want to start just by sort of telling me a bit about yourself, sort of generally outside of microscopic colitis before we go into it?
Yeah, I was a teacher for 45 years until I retired in the August of 20, and had a very healthy lifestyle. I was a food teacher, so knew all the sort of things that I should be doing. And yes, I was doing all of those. I've always liked to keep fit, even if it's just by walking. And actually, since lockdown occurred, you know, when we were only allowed out the house once a day or whatever, I started walking. And I've continued doing that ever since. So every day I walk at least twice or possibly three times a day, particularly in the summer. So I'd always thought, yeah, I've never had any major problems at all. So it was completely out of the blue when this all started.
Well done you for kind of keeping up the walking during COVID. I wish I had done that. We lived next to a park during COVID, and I think that, I mean, we lived in that flat for I think about 6 years, and we visited that park during COVID more times than we ever had in the entirety of the rest of the time that we'd been there. Really got to know it.
Yeah, exactly. A lifesaver.
Absolutely. I do love a good walk. So tell me about how it all started then. What were your symptoms or what triggered sort of needing to get this diagnosis?
Well, it all sort of started about November in 2020. And I just noticed that the frequency of emptying my bowels, it was only like once a day. But I never missed that, if you know what I mean. And the stools were a lot looser. And so I didn't think too much about it because I've always had a high fibre diet. And I just thought, well, perhaps I've eaten too much fruit that day, you know, something like that. But it wasn't. And then I started losing a little bit of weight. I'm not big anyway. And I remember I took part in a vaccine programme. I was on a placebo at the time, but I didn't know that. And I sort of maybe thought it was linked to that a little bit. So didn't take a great deal of store by it. But by February in 2021, as you mentioned, on the Monday, I'd been suffering from chronic diarrhea. So I was having to go to the toilet, dash to the toilet, may I say, with urgency, eight times. And also waking up in the night, I suffered a little bit from fecal incontinence during the night, suffering from nausea, as well as the weight loss. And the weight went down from 52 to 50 grams, which I know it isn't a lot, and it's only classed as mild, but for somebody who doesn't weigh a lot anyway, you know, I could notice the difference.
Yeah.
Just by not even weighing myself, but just by looking, you know, at my own body and my clothes. Particularly trousers, you could see a difference. So I managed to get into an emergency appointment on the Tuesday to see a doctor. And actually, it was a third year student doctor, along with the normal GP, and just explained, she felt my tummy. And then they ordered blood tests and asked me to bring in a stool sample, which I'd already done the FIT test, you know, the national screening for bowel cancer in the November, and that come back as no problem at all, so negative. And so they just told me to keep drinking. I wasn't really eating anything because it just went straight through me. So they, as they organised blood tests, I was supposed to go to a park and ride station. You know, at that time when they had COVID tests, well, this had been taken over by blood testing station the other side of Cambridge. And I just said, I can't get there. Well, I could get there, sorry. But if I had an incident where I needed the toilet urgently, I couldn't manage. So thankfully, they managed to do it at the doctor's on the Wednesday. So I had a whole range of blood tests. They tested also for celiac as well. And then I had an appointment on the Friday. Now, by the Friday, the diarrhea had slowed down. So it was only, I think, twice a day, but with great urgency. And certainly on waking in the morning, you just had to get straight out of bed and go straight to the toilet. There was no two ways about it. And again, it was very loose in consistency, but not like the watery that I'd had on the Monday and Tuesday. So I went back on the Friday. They hadn't received the tests back, the FIT test, but they had got the calciprotein test, and that was abnormal. But it wasn't in the huge range where, you know, they have to do something about it. But they decided, with the other symptoms that I was suffering from, they would put me on the cancer fast track, the two-week fast track, which is based at Addenbrooke. So I'm very fortunate to have Addenbrooke on my doorstep, just to check for colorectal cancer, you know, to see whether that was a problem. Now, at the time, I didn't realise the GP, and I only realised this the other day when I was looking through my notes, that the GP had actually diagnosed that but hadn't told me. So I only found that out about a week ago. In the back of his mind. So that's, I mean, that was great that he was able to identify it, but obviously he didn't like to give me a diagnosis, you know, before further tests had been carried out.
Well, I'm sure it could have been lots of different things, couldn't it? Yes, because the symptoms that you describe are, you know, also linked to bowel cancer and other things. Yes. There's a lot of crossover, weight loss and change in your sort of stool habits. And it could have been. So it's good that they were testing for all sorts of things to find out which one it was.
Yeah. And in fact, there's one thing I forgot to say. There was no blood in the stools, because that is a red flag, you know, for bowel cancer and for ulcerated colitis as well. So there was none of that. So my appointment came through on the fast track for March. It was at March 19th, I think it was. And I had to have an endoscopic examination. So obviously, for people who don't know, I think the worst thing is the prep that you have to do for it. And you have to take a powder substance over a day, depending on when your examination's going to be, and basically stop eating and be near a toilet, because basically it's a very powerful laxative which cleans out the colon completely, because they need to have, basically, I know it sounds a bit odd, a clear passage for the camera to be able to go through the colon and just see if there's any difficulties. So I went along for that. In the meanwhile, the diarrhea had ceased, but still very soft stools and very loud rumblings in my abdomen. So I had my daughter with me, who was 28 years old, and she could hear my abdomen from the other side of the room. So if you can imagine being, you know, when you're really hungry, and your tummy rumbles, well, if you could amplify that at least 6 or 7 times.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, exactly. And also suffering from frequent wind. And I have to say, it was foul smelling winds. If you can imagine bad eggs.
Yeah.
Hydrogen sulfide. So like that. And also extreme fatigue as well. So you just can't do anything. Or if you do, and you think you can do a bit more next day, you suffer from it, you know, for the day after. Yeah. So I went along for the procedure. was sedated, and basically you know what's happening, and you can actually watch on the screen. And then that didn't take very long at all. And while I was just in recovery, the consultant said, it's microscopic colitis, but what we've done is we've done some biopsies, which we're going to send off to confirm, but there's no signs of bowel cancer. So obviously I was very relieved at that, because my husband had suffered from bowel cancer previous 2 years and had to have an operation. So of course that was obviously in the back of my mind. So I mean, that was good that I felt like that. So you know what you do, you get home. I slept all afternoon because of the sedation, but next day, Google doctor, here we go, what's microscopic colitis? And you don't know whether that's a bad thing or a good thing, but I tried to use recognised sites, so gut health, bowel and bladder website, as well as NHS. But I have to say the NHS has very little information at all on microscopic colitis.
I guess, had you even heard of microscopic colitis before? No.
And in fact, I know we're going to talk about it a little bit later, but there are two types of microscopic colitis. But perhaps I'll talk about that a little bit later, Sam, so you can see the difference. And then obviously I had to wait for the appointment to come through from the clinic, the gastro clinic. And that came through in April. And I've never actually seen the consultant face to face. It's always been a video call. And that was obviously part of, you know, COVID procedure at that time. But it didn't really matter because I'd had the tests. And he thought, because my symptoms had calmed down, then to just have loperamide. Now, loperamide, just in case people aren't aware, they're the sort of tablets, the anti-diarrhea tablets, that if you go on holiday, you take them with you for holiday tummy, or one of the types that you can take with you.
Yeah, like Imodium, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly it. But he said that if that didn't help, then he would prescribe busidamide, which is a steroid which is targeted for the bowel. So people throw their hands up in horror when they hear the word steroid, because they think, you know, the guinea pig face and putting on weight and other side effects. But I have to say, because this is targeted for the bowel, I didn't get any of those symptoms at all.
And that reduces the inflammation, does it, the steroid?
Within a few days. I couldn't believe the difference it made.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's always sort of a case of targeting the symptoms and trying to reduce the symptoms rather than something that will actually sort of change the underlying cause. Yeah,
that's it. And so I had a course for, it was 8 weeks at 3 tablets a day. And then it was, and then I went down to 2 tablets a day. And then that was for another 2 weeks. And then after that, it was 1 tablet a day for another 2 weeks. And then you have to stop completely, because steroids are designed for not long-term use. And you can't just come off them. If, for example, I thought, oh, I'm a lot better now, I don't need to take these tablets, I don't like to take tablets, you can't do that with steroids. You've got to titrate them down. In other words, you've got to reduce them. So the body can just get used to the effects, you know, that it's been producing in the body.
Yeah. Do you know what happens if you do just stop taking steroids? What effect does that have?
I don't really know, Sam. I wanted to make sure, you know, because the consultant was giving me this advice to follow it, you know, by the letter.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Which I did do. Yeah. So I finished those in October, because the consultant said he would see me in 6 months' time. Now, within a week, can you believe it, of finishing the steroids, I developed the chronic diarrhea again.
Right.
So basically, it's like a flare-up. So I didn't do anything differently, with the exception of stopping the medication. So I'd got bloating, I'd got the weight loss, I'd got the nausea. Now, the nausea this time was far worse, and I had to get anti-sickness tablets from the GP to combat that. So I emailed the medical secretary of the consultants and just explained what had been happening. And she got in touch with the consultant, and the consultant suggested that if the loperamide didn't work, and I'd been taking it because I, in the back of my mind, I remember him saying, if it starts up again, start with that first. But that was just making me constipated. So I thought, there's no point in continuing with this, you know, get the consultant's advice. So the GP then prescribed a full course again, which I started taking.
Just of the steroids?
Yes, of the same steroids. Because obviously he'd got the consultant's letters. Now, I was supposed to have an appointment later on in November, but that was cancelled again. I think it was because of COVID. So I managed to get one in February. After finishing that second course, I then started again with the colitis. And again, exactly the same symptoms. And what I tried to do is I tried to manage it for as long as I could. But you know, when your quality of life is, you're thinking, this is pointless. I can't go out. I'm being interrupted in the night. I've got to be so careful what I'm eating. I'm losing weight and I can't afford to lose weight. So again, I phoned up the gastro clinic and spoke to a specialist nurse, who then got in touch with the consultant again, and he prescribed the third course of bufidamide, again, full course, and just taking it, you know, for that period of time, and then to come off. Now, he told me in my February appointment that I'd got steroid-dependent microscopic colitis.
Right.
So what he did then is he put me on a low maintenance dose of the same steroid, and that was 3 milligrams a day. And actually, that did the trick. Again, that stopped those symptoms. And then I took that for the 6 months until the next time that I spoke to him. I'd had a few flare-ups in the meantime. I love spicy food, or I did like
me too.
Spicy food. Mm. And that's the one biggest thing I miss. So I thought I would treat myself to a couple of onion bhajis.
Uh-oh.
Well, was that a mistake?
Oh, no.
Yes. I suffered for several days afterwards with an upset tummy, the bloating, the abdominal spasms. Because of that. So,
what a shame.
Yeah, I obviously realised that spicy foods are a major trigger. And so I have to be very careful of what I eat. And so I then had the 3 milligram a day for the 6 months. And then the last appointment was last May. Oh, no, sorry, before that, Sam, an appointment. And he said, take 3 milligrams every other day and see how you manage.
Right.
Which I did for another 6 months. That leads us till May of last year. And he said, well, it seems like you're managing, just come off it. But if you get any flare-ups, then I'm to get straight in touch with the medical secretary, who'll organise the blood tests. She'll organise the sigmoscope rather than the endoscopic procedure, because it's in the lower colon.
Yeah, the flexible sigmoidoscopy, so you don't need a full colonoscopy.
Yeah. I mean, you still have to do the prep.
Yeah.
I think, because I've not had it. So, touching wood, crossing fingers and everything, I've been okay.
For a flexible sigmoidoscopy, because I have these every year or every couple of years, I do an at-home enema. So I don't have to have the full prep. Yeah, I don't know if it will be the same for you. But yeah, because it doesn't go in very far, I just need to do an enema before I go in.
Oh, right. Oh.
Well, giving good news on the podcast today.
Well, you see, the thing is, this sort of information, that they don't always fully understand. You might read it, but we don't always fully understand, you know, what's involved.
Yeah.
So I should have another appointment coming up in May. So what I'm going to do is get in touch with the medical secretary and see if one's in the pipeline and see. But what I am going to do is, because I've noticed in the last maybe 4 months or so that when I eat my evening meal, I get bloated, but I also suffer from frequent non-smelly wind. And I thought it might be a good idea to get a test done for celiac and then hopefully got the results for when I have my appointment with the consultant. So that's something that could be ruled out. But I've still got to get that organised. So that's my job for next week.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of sort of admin work, isn't there, around being a patient and having to organise all these things. It does my head in, to be honest.
Funny you should say that, Sam, because when I was first diagnosed, before I saw the consultants in the April of 2021, I started keeping a bowel diary. Now, people are probably thinking, what?
No, that's a good idea. Yeah, that's good.
And so what I did is every day, without fail, depending on how I felt, I would monitor my stool, how many stools I had that day. And I have to say, the consistency of them. Because I use the Bristol stool chart, which I knew nothing about before all this, and it gives you the different stages. And then I used to email that to the medical secretary before. So the three occasions when I was on the three full courses of budesonide, the consultant always had my bowel diary. So he's got that information, you know, before I actually speak to him. So it gives them an overall picture. Yeah, that helped.
Oh, that's a good idea. And the Bristol stool chart, is that the one where it has sort of drawn pictures of like the consistency of poo? Like here's a really solid one here, and all the way up to like basically a liquidy one.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a good idea.
That's internationally recognised.
Yeah. Well, when I had my stoma reversed and my internal pouch, because it takes a while for the internal pouch to kind of learn to absorb the fluids and start working properly, you do have very loose stools for the first few days or a couple of weeks. So I did a similar thing. I used to keep an Excel spreadsheet of just like writing down how many times I've been to the toilet, which is why I remember now that the first couple of days I was going about 14 times a day, but then it eventually sort of reduced to about 7 after a week or two. So
because the thing is, Sam, and I know people say this, if you go to a medical appointment, always write down beforehand the questions you want to ask, because in the moment, it's very easy to forget. So by doing that as well, that helped me, because I'd have it at the side of me when we did, you know, the video calls. So I could, you know, refer to it and identify a particular occasion if I had a flare up.
Yeah. And then you can write down the answers to their questions as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Shall we talk about the two different types of microscopic colitis? And I know you're quite knowledgeable in your condition, which I think is great. I think, you know, knowledge is power, and that's really good, because I think people tend to fall in a camp of either wanting to know as much as possible or, like myself, I used to fall into the camp of, I do not want to know anything. I don't even want to think about it. I'm understandably now working for a research charity. I'm not quite that way anymore. But yeah, I do think it's great to sort of know about your condition. So do you want to tell us about the two different types of microscopic colitis?
Certainly. One thing I would say, Sam, before we start, is I try and tell as many people as possible to try and get the message out there. In fact, I've got a next door but one neighbour who 6 weeks ago started with similar symptoms. I persuaded her to go to the doctor and she's just been diagnosed with Crohn's.
Oh.
Yeah. So she was coming to me and asking me, she said, well, I don't really want to ask you. This is quite personal. I said, no. No, let me just explain. So she had a little bit, I know it's not the same, but she had a little bit more of an understanding of what was going to happen to her when she was going through the procedure. So I think that helped her in some way, So I think the more people who know about it, so they can recognise, and even if they haven't got the colitis, it may make them go to the doctor to just get investigated.
Yeah, because as we said before, you know, there's a lot of symptoms that could actually be multiple different things, even though they share the same sort of crossover of symptoms. And yeah, definitely, the more people that talk about it, the better. Yeah, we need to do away with the stigma entirely, yeah. I think, so we can just have these open conversations.
Yeah, indeed. So microscopic colitis, I think it's a bit like an umbrella. And then underneath the umbrella are two different types. So there's the collagenous colitis, that's the one that I have. And there's the lymphatic colitis. So my collagenous, just underneath the lining of the colon, is everybody's got a layer of collagen. And they're like, they're protein, it's protein building blocks. But unfortunately, with the collagenous, the collagen has become thickened. And so it makes it difficult for any liquids to be absorbed by the body. And so that means it leaves even more watery waste actually in the colon, which has got to be excreted via the rectum.
Right, so that makes sense.
That's, you know, the chronic watery diarrhea. And that happens when it becomes inflamed. But also with the collagenous, you have more white blood cells as well. So that's another way that they can tell. Now, the lymphatic colitis, they have a lot more white blood cells and there's no thickening of the lining at all. So that's how they can tell. Now, what I forgot to say is when they did the endoscopic procedure, they just by looking at the lining can't tell you've got collagenous colitis. That's why they have to do the biopsies. Right. So that has to be seen underneath the microscope. As some forms of bowel cancer, they can determine just by sight, you know, through the camera.
Yeah.
So both have similar symptoms. They are associated with autoimmune diseases. So, for example, celiac. So again, that's why, you know, I mentioned before, I'm going to get tested again. Thyroid disorders, which I hadn't realised. But if you smoke, you are more at risk from it as well. And also some medications. So some non-steroid inflammatory, anti-inflammatory drugs. So in particular, ibuprofen, aspirin and naproxen. Now, I didn't realise, Sam, that I started becoming unwell in the sort of November 2020. In August 2020, I had chronic lower back pain where basically I couldn't move and I was put on a course of naproxen. Now, I had the gastro tablets to go with it because it is a known risk, you know, to causing stomach problems. I don't know if it was that triggered it. I've never really, the only tablets I take are vitamin D and calcium anyway. So I've never been one, you know, for taking over-the-counter medications. If I've got a headache, I just, you know, put up with it, drink extra water and whatever. So I don't know if it's linked to that. But they also say it could have been caused by a virus infection. And I hadn't had a virus infection. Or it can be genetically linked. But none of my parents, neither of my parents, you know, suffered. So, you know, it's hard, really. And the thing is, this microscopic colitis, you're more likely to get it between the ages of 50 and 70.
Right.
And it's more likely to be women.
Oh, OK.
Yeah, men can get it, but it's more likely to be women. So there's still an awful lot of research to be done on it because it tends to be one of the types of, well, it is classed as an inflammatory bowel disease. So it is IBD.
Yeah.
It's a forgotten one if you know what I mean. And that's why there's not an awful lot of information out there about it.
Yeah, but people know quite well, people are more likely to have heard of ulcerative colitis. Yes. Should we mention here what the difference is between ulcerative colitis and microscopic?
Certainly. So what happens here is the immune system starts attacking the lining of the gut. And because it starts doing that, that's where the colon and the rectum become inflamed and it thickens and it causes small ulcers. And the small ulcers become ulcerated and they can bleed and produce the pus. So you mentioned, you know, I mentioned before about it was non-blood stools. Well, in this case, there is blood present in the stools.
Okay, so that might have shown up on a fit test.
Yes, exactly. And I think that is one of the things they sort of automatically look for when they do the fit test, you know, with this bowel screening.
Yeah.
It is visible through a colonoscopy and it can be detected with other tests. As microscopic colitis, really, it's only the biopsies for certain and the calprotein test. You can still have a high amount shown in it, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's colitis.
Can you explain what a calprotein test is?
It's the blood test that they do, and I think they're looking for the white blood cells in there. I think that's it.
Yeah.
Now, with the ulcerated colitis, it affects the body in other ways. So I'm just so grateful I haven't got it. It's joint pain and swelling. You can get swelling in the eyes, mouth ulcers, skin rashes. Fatigue is the same that I get, but also because of how it affects the body greatly, mental health problems as well.
Yeah.
And it is... there's no cure for it, as there isn't microscopic colitis, but there is an increased risk of cancer, as there isn't, or it's very rare with microscopic colitis, very rare indeed.
Yeah. So can I just ask, because you mentioned that, I mean, you had the colonoscopy initially to diagnose the microscopic colitis, and you said that you might also be having a flexible sigmoidoscopy. So what is the purpose of having the flexible sigmoidoscopy? Is that to see kind of if it's progressed or
if it's still an active disease?
Right.
That's what the consultants say, to make to see whether it's active or not. So if I'd had a flare up, they would have organized that and they can tell, you know, from that, whether the collagen layer is inflamed, you know, it's thickened, and whether it's inflamed, because it only affects the colon rather than the earlier part of the large intestine. So that's why he said, I think he assumed I'd had that before.
Oh, okay.
But I'd had the full colonoscopy, but I'd rather have had that, Sam, and they found nothing else there, because obviously they could find, you know, like polyps and could deal with those, but thankfully, you know, I didn't have any of those.
Well, it's reassuring that they did sort of a full check. And you mentioned before about spicy food potentially causing a flare-up, which is a real shame. I love spicy food as well. It's really annoying when these things affect your diet. Is there anything else that causes a flare-up, or what have you sort of learned about it over time as to what foods are good for you to eat and what foods not so much?
I made a hearty soup about a month ago, lots of vegetables, and I put in a can of chickpeas, you know, to boost the protein content as well. Well, I struggled with that, you know, again for several days afterwards. So when I make that now, I have to divide it. So my husband has the bean, you know, the chickpeas in there, and then I have mine without it. And one of my favourites is beans on toast, or jacket potato and beans and cheese. I can only have one tablespoon at the most of baked beans, where before I could manage, you know, like half a can. So I try and make sure my diet is high in fiber. So, for example, I always have overnight oats in the morning for breakfast, and try and eat lots of fruits and vegetables. But another thing is alcohol. Have to limit alcohol. I've never been a big drinker, don't get me wrong, but if there's a celebration, I can't have more than 2 glasses of small wine, because again, that will trigger it. So it's not just the day after, you know, it will be for several days afterwards, and I'll suffer from spasms, which I can get away with using a hot water bottle, but you certainly don't feel like going out anywhere, you know, just in case you develop the urgency. I mean, I still have the urgency now, Sam. And what are we now? 3 years?
Yeah.
Since I've had it. Yeah. So, yeah, it's something you learn to live with, as I'm sure you're doing as well. And you see, the thing is, I'm a vegetarian. I don't eat eggs. That's just through personal choice. I'm not keen on eggs.
Yeah.
I don't like tofu. I don't like corn. I don't like these meat alternatives, if you know what I mean. So I find that my diet is very bland and, yes, can be very boring. And that's what I find hard. There's only so many things you can do with the vegetables, if you know what I mean. Because I've got to, with the pulses, I would be normally having, you know, a large amount of those daily, but I can't because it affects it.
Yeah. And it's surprising as well sometimes, isn't it, what food affects our bowels and how, because sometimes, like, the healthy foods that you think you should be eating and that most people would be sort of recommended to eat actually could have a detrimental effect.
That's exactly it. Exactly it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's hard trying to get that balance right.
Yeah. And it just shows as well that it's not sort of a one size fits all thing for all bowels, really. But I'm imagining that two people with microscopic colitis, like, food might affect them both in different ways, like, nobody is the same in that way.
I mean, what I try and do is every now and again, we mentioned about spicy foods, is just see if I can, and I use the onion bhaji because that's a good one, you know, that you can try. So I had one, I think it was about 3 weeks ago, and it upset me a little bit.
Yeah.
So the thing is, I don't know if this is you as well, Sam, but I find that there comes a time when I think, do you know what? I'm dying to have something spicy. And I have it. And I think to myself, well, if my tummy's going to be upset next morning, then it's going to be upset.
Yeah.
But for the moment, do you know what I mean? For the moment.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I go to my parents' house every Friday and my dad makes chili. And I know Dad's chili is awesome, it's so good, but I know that, especially because it's eating it in the evening, I'm going to be up several times in the night, and I'm going to have, like, butt burn, you know, it's going to be as spicy going out as it was coming in, and I'm going to have sort of wake up in the night with urgency, and I might have some nighttime incontinence because of it. I'm not going to stop eating Dad's chili.
No.
My pouch just has to deal with it, and it's a sacrifice I'm willing to make.
I fully understand. So we mentioned before, Sam, you know, at the beginning when I wouldn't go out because of the urgency, and that's what I found very hard to deal with, because I'm a sort of person who just likes to get out and about.
I mean, did it impact your walks and stuff like that?
And so what I was finding is that if I wanted to go out, when my colitis wasn't that bad, I'd have to wait until I'd been to the toilet, because I couldn't go out thinking, oh, my God, I've got to make sure I know where all the toilets are. Now, saying that, there was one time I visit my sister every week, and she lives 90 miles away, and I was travelling on the A14. And bearing in mind that I'd had the urgency in the morning, I had to pull off the A14 within 15 minutes of travelling. And luckily there was a McDonald's near, and I only just made it.
Oh, God. That's so annoying when you've planned for it as well, and you think, oh, I'm going to be good for a little while. And then,
And I also bought myself a radar key.
Oh, yeah.
Radar is for the use of disabled toilets. But I have to say, not all disabled toilets take a radar key, which I didn't realise.
Some of them are just locked with another. Yeah,
I found that out in Leicester one time when we went shopping. Yes. And also I downloaded from the bladder and bowel community a card, and it's called Just Can't Wait. And I've got that in my wallet on my iPhone. To tell you the truth, I've not used it. But I just wonder how many people, if you showed it maybe to people in cafes or shops, you know, where maybe you haven't gone in to buy anything, would allow you to actually use their toilets.
So yeah, funny you should say that, actually, because I saw something on Twitter yesterday where somebody was saying that they have one of those cards, and he went to a supermarket and the toilets were closed. It seems like because he wasn't in the area, he didn't realise that, this had just closed their public toilets for a considerable amount of time for whatever reason. And he showed the staff the card and they wouldn't let him use their staff toilets.
That's appalling.
There needs to be more understanding.
And the thing is, Sam, councils, I was only reading last week, a lot of councils, because of their lack of money, are actually closing public toilets. So that certainly doesn't help people who have bowel symptoms, you know, bowel conditions or any other conditions where they need to use toilets, you know, when they're out.
Yeah, and I feel like it was a thing during COVID as well, that some of the public toilets, like in my local shopping centre, the toilets were closed. It's like, well, what good is that to somebody who, you know, needs to get out about, do their shopping and needs the toilet, you know?
Yeah. So it's a bit like having to plan your journey so you know where the toilets are. Not necessarily when you're in the non-flare-up stage, but certainly, you know, if you are succumbing to a flare-up.
Yeah. And as well, I guess what you eat factors into that as well. And like you wouldn't, you know, try a bargee, you know, before a long journey sort of thing.
No, not at all. No.
Is there anything else to mention that we haven't covered, or any sort of final things that you would like to leave people with regarding microscopic colitis?
Just, I know I've already mentioned these two, Sam, but just to say again, if you notice any changes in your bowel habits, don't leave it for months. I'm not saying if I'd gone in November, you know, it would be any better, because I think once you've got the inflammation of the colon, you've got it, because as I say, there's no cure. So certainly if you notice any changes, or, you know, frequency or consistency without any real reason why that is, then just go along, make a nuisance of yourself. I mean, I think I was very fortunate with my new GP who spotted it, and also, you know, the third year student who was very good and very thorough. I mean, one thing I did forget to say, Sam, and I suppose people need to know this, and I hope it doesn't put them off, that when I did go for the second doctor's appointment in that week, she did do a rectal examination. So basically lubricant on a finger, in a glove, obviously, so she could feel around the back passage. So again, that's like an early diagnosis, you know, if there's any lumps or whatever. Yeah. But not to be put off, it doesn't hurt. It just doesn't hurt. I think it's a thought that puts people off. And it's far better to get it, to go along and let them do the investigations. And then lastly, Sam, like I said before, make use of the medical secretary. She's like the go-between. And my consultant's got a fabulous young lady who I can email first thing in the morning or at night time, you know, for example, with those bowel diaries. And she'll be back to me by 8:30 the following morning.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah. So, yeah, make use of the medical secretary, because actually my consultant calls her his PA. And that's basically, what she's doing. She's managing his diary.
And we should say, for the symptoms as well, it's really recognizing something that's different for you, isn't it? And knowing what's normal for you, as in sort of a change in bowel habits, because we all know, like, oh yeah, I go to the toilet once a day or whatever. if only that was still true for me. But yeah, it's just recognizing, you know, because we are all different, but what is, you know, what is normal for you and what feels out of the ordinary for you.
Yes.
And actually, something that I forgot to ask, because you used to teach food and nutrition, didn't you? So do you feel like that experience has helped you? How has that kind of impacted how you're dealing with all of this?
Yes, it has, Sam, because I mean, I'm trying to maintain the healthy diet within the parameters that I know I've got to keep to. And so try and substitute other foods instead. So if I haven't tried a particular vegetable or fruit, then I'll try those out and see if that helps, you know, with the trying to vary my diet.
Yeah.
Because I have to say, when I was first diagnosed with it, all I was eating was soup all the time. And a banana. Because apparently bananas are very good.
Right.
And applesauce. Well, who eats applesauce? I think that's come from the States.
And how much of it would you need to eat for it to be effective?
Well, I think it's just to make sure that you're getting nutrition.
Sure.
Not.
Yeah.
Not
You
know, help the symptoms. It's just making sure that you're getting nutrition into the body.
Yeah, that makes sense. Diane, it's been really great to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for coming and having such an open conversation. And hopefully people have learned a thing or two. And yeah, we'll try and highlight microscopic colitis a bit more, so there's more awareness around it.
It can take, for some patients, years before they're diagnosed with microscopic colitis, because the health practitioners are not so aware of it. They're aware of Crohn's and, you know, the other types of IBD, but microscopic colitis is low down there. And so I'm extremely fortunate that I was able to be diagnosed, you know, within that very short time span.
Yeah. What was the time span kind of from symptoms to diagnosis?
So for the first time I went to the GP, that was February 2021.
Yeah.
Diagnosed April 21.
Pretty good, yeah.
Yeah. So that's very good. Very good. And people just need to keep badgering, you know, if they're not getting the diagnosis.
Yeah, advocate for yourself, which, I mean, I say that it is very hard, and I find it quite difficult. But yeah, you can be your own best advocate for sure.
Yes. Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. Lovely. Well, it's been so lovely to talk to you, Diane. Thank you very much.
OK, thank you, Sam. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Can I Button? This podcast was brought to you by Bowel Research UK. Find out more about the charity, our work, and how you can get involved. Visit bowelresearchuk.org, where you can join our People and Research Together network, or PART, read about our research campaigns and fundraising, or make a donation to support the vital work we do. Let's end bowel cancer and bowel disease.